can survive if I let you.
Conquering nevermore.
Let the new era begin. The era of the ECW.
Oh my God. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to This is Extreme, an ECW history podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty, and I know it's been a long, long time since we've had an episode. I keep telling you on social media, we're not dead. This is just going to be, I guess, a sporadic thing. At some point, I hope to get to some kind of regular schedule, but for now, there'll be some special episodes here and there, and this is one of them. Any of you that know me know I also have another podcast, my primary podcast. It's called Wrestling Nostalgia. And on it, I currently just interviewed Todd Gordon, of course, the ECW founder. He has a new book out called Todd is God, the authorized story of how I created Extreme Championship Wrestling. And I did an interview for Wrestling Nostalgia for that. And I thought, well, this would be, you know, it'd be a great opportunity to take that interview and also put it in an episode of This is Extreme, because this is obviously the target audience, right? The ECW fans. So this, you know, you guys are the ones that would really benefit and enjoy this interview more. So full disclosure, yes, this podcast is also released on my Wrestling Nostalgia podcast, the exact same interview. But like I said, I wanted to also release it in this feed for those of you who just listened to the This is Extreme podcast. So let's get right to it. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for sticking with us during all these pauses and everything else. Again, there will be some episodes here and there. Hopefully at some point we'll get back to a regular schedule, so stick with us. But let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll have that interview with ECW founder Todd Gordon. Be sure to follow This is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback. So find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution. This is Extreme. I am now joined by Todd Gordon, the founder of ECW, who now has available the book Todd is God, the authorized story of how I created Extreme Championship Wrestling. It's available at all major book retailers. Todd, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Dave?
I'm doing good. Doing good. I'm glad to be on here talking to you. I very much enjoyed your book, and I highly advise everybody go out and get a copy and read it. But I'm excited to talk to you and hear some more stories.
You're one of the first people, I think, to get a copy of the book. I remember you posted that. You had gotten a copy like weeks before anybody else did.
Yeah. I have contacts with a lot of the publishers and do a lot of book reviews and things. And they know I have a wrestling podcast. So when they have a new wrestling print, they just send them to me. So yeah,
that's great.
Yep. Yeah. So why'd you feel this was the right time to write the book?
You know, it was nothing about the right time. I just never had any desire or plan to ever write a book. And Sean, my co-author, he from Kayfabe Commentaries, you know, he just hounded me day in and day out for like literally 2 full years. I was just hanging out on the phone. I would tell him a story or another story, and he'd be screaming with laughter. He goes, Todd, we've got to put this in the book. I said, no, I'm not doing a book. We went back and forth, back and forth. Finally, y'all but wore me down. And also, there were things that I thought really needed to be cleared up and rectified. As I'm getting older now, some, you know, parts of my legacy were really not accurate, the way I can put it. Yeah. And I wanted to make sure they were put out there accurately so people would actually know what really happened. Because it's such an important part of a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, definitely is. And like you said, because throughout time, typically those who quote-unquote win write the history. And that's certainly kind of what's happened with ECW now that, you know, now that the WWE owns it and Paul Heyman works for them, you know, they kind of get to write the history, and that's what's accepted a lot of times. So, you know, Paul's often, or I guess always now, marketed as the force behind ECW. So, I mean, were you kind of, even prior to wanting to write the book, did you worry about kind of being forgotten over time and your impact on ECW? I mean, you were the guy that founded it. You created that style. You hired Paul, you worked with Paul, and yet, you know, he's the one that's always talked about as being, you know, Mr. ECW.
It's true that eventually, it's, you know, you can paint a picture any way you want, and they eventually start painting it as Paul Heyman's ECW. I said, well, that's interesting. I mean, I was running that thing for a couple of years before Paul even got hired. So that's interesting. And I just figured, you know what, let it be, let it be. But I kept getting seeing all these DVDs coming out, books coming out, The Rise and Fall of ECW, The History of Extreme Championship Wrestling, The Unauthorized Story. Why were they all the unauthorized story? Because no one ever interviewed me once for one of those projects. How can you talk about the rise and fall of a company when the guy who built it and started it didn't even talk to or interviewed? Either was Joey Styles, either was Shane Douglas. If you weren't a WWE employee, you weren't going to be part of it. And that's why it was called The Unauthorized Story. So I said, you know what? Maybe it's time to write the authorized story. You know what really actually did happen since I was there watching it all happen day by day.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah, like I said, everybody talks about Paul Heyman. And I'm not undermining Paul, his creativity and what he does. But, you know, Paul was in that position because of you. And you founded the company. You hired Paul Heyman to be the booker. You know, you did all this. And all this is in the book, right? You explain all this and how it happened.
Well, yes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's great. Like you said, you know, talking with Sean, it's literally just like sitting down and listening to you tell stories. Sean did a great job of conveying it over into a book. It feels just very conversational. I like that in a book, you know, where it doesn't read like, you know, an educational text. It feels like a conversation with Todd Gordon.
That's really what it was. I mean, we did the Zoom for like, you know, 2-4 hours a shot, maybe 3-4 times a week over 8 months. I mean, there was so much material we kind of cut out of the book just to get it down to a readable size. And I would just tell stories and say, tell me about some road stories or you and Sandman or whatever the case may be. And I'd go into one of my Sandman stories and he'd be rolling on the floor. And the more stories I would get, he just built them all up. His job, which is no easy task, believe me, was trying to figure out the chronological order all these things happened in and put them all in the right order and line them all up successfully in succession. And he really did do a masterful job of that, I got to be honest with you. Yeah. So really, when it sounds like me talking to you, the reader, I'm really talking to Sean, the reader. I mean, it's the same basic idea. He just had to put it all in the right form for me.
Yeah. Like I said, he did a great job. And you talked about, you know, telling your, you know, this obviously you telling your story. And you talked about how for years you just, let it go. It doesn't matter. Whatever. But that seems kind of the opposite of pro wrestling, typically, right? Pro wrestling, it's all about the grudges and the heat, right? And people are quick to do a shoot interview and try to bury someone else just to make a few bucks. You haven't been like that, right? I mean, you've had all the opportunity over all these years that you could have told these stories. You could have got this out there in a million ways. Do you kind of feel, why is your approach different? Is it maybe your business background and some of the connections you've had over the years and the deals you've made that, I mean, it seems to be completely 180 of most wrestlers.
Well, this is also sounding like 180 of most wrestlers also. I think it was a lack of ego in that regard. I mean, it wasn't that important to me for all those years. You know, I was out of the business now. So is it that important to me to have that legacy continue? I'm not sure. Then all of a sudden, as I said, I started getting older, approaching 70. I thought, you know, it would be nice. What happened was, though, when I saw Paul's DVD come out, Paul Heyman, I don't know what it's called, he even asked me to be on it. We went down to the arena and gave him some interviews also for that. And I'm watching it when it came out a few weeks later, and I'm like, wait, what? He was still going along with this work that we had perpetrated 27 years ago, and he had worked the boys in the locker room, and I realized that he never smartened them up. After all those years, he'd never smartened them up. I mean, my friends, you know, the Sabus, the Fonzies, the Sandman, they all knew the deal, so there's no reason to smarten them up, but I just assumed he had smartened up all the guys from New York. You know, the Dreamer, Bubba, Taz, and whoever was up there, and he never did. And I thought, that's pretty messed up. I guess he was afraid of tarnishing his legacy as his star was growing and growing and growing. But if I'd have known that years ago, 10 years ago, maybe I'd have written the book then. I don't know. But that was part of the impetus to go ahead and write it and tell people what really happened. But that's not the only part of the book, obviously. It's a focal point. Because people didn't know that no one knew the story. So it's something brand new that people were hearing, like, imagine that, Paul lied. But it was the undermining of the company. It was the backstabbing, and there was a lot of going on there, and all that spelled out in the book.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like you said, ECW is such an important part of so many people's lives. I mean, not only the wrestlers, not only you, not only Paul, even us as fans that watched it, right? And it was just perfect for the time. It just fit everything, and it whether people acknowledge it or not,
I mean, ECW changed the course of wrestling, and it was emulated by, you know, WWE, WCW. I mean, you know, this little East Coast promotion totally changed the approach of wrestling. And so what was involved with you and Paul, you know, kind of being open to these new trends, these pop culture references, and, you know, wrestling's notoriously kind of stuck in the past and unwilling to change. And you guys were very hip and even ahead of the curve. What caused that?
Well, for one thing, we really didn't have a lot of people looking down our, you know, down our hole, so to speak, to see what we're doing there. We were really kind of going underneath the radar, using the kind of music we use without any permission to use it. But the music, by the way, Paul picked all the music. You know, I was still like, you know, classic rock 70s guy, and he was always ahead of the curve. So he brought up the grunge music and got the Public Enemy going with their music, and each person's song, you know, was more hip than the one before. And I love the music when I heard it, but he was the one who was turning me on to it all the time. I mean, don't misunderstand, he's a genius. I mean, the guy's a straight out stone cold genius. The thoughts he comes up with, the angles, when we would sit together at night and just come up with an angle for, you know, whoever it may be, and we start expanding on it. I mean, his brilliance was all over the place. But unfortunately, you have to have be a person and a human being to go along with that. You can't just be a machine.
Yeah.
Kevin Sullivan used to always say he needs to be locked up like a crazy professor in a room by himself, so he doesn't ever talk to anybody, and just let him go to work and come up with, you know, angles and stories and things like that. But I would say that in terms of the audience, and I'm saying to you, the audience was as much a part of the show as we were.
Right.
I mean, you could, if you could take out the salmon, you're still the audience. You know, if you take out the audience, you still, it's a symbiotic relationship, I would say.
Yeah.
Where we really felt like the audience was part of the show from the very beginning when they started bringing their own weapons to the show. Nobody had ever done that before. So we were already involving them, integrating them into our being. The fact that the wrestlers would fight all over the arena, front to back, so there was never a, you know, bad seat. And no fans ever touched them. No one ever bothered them. They moved out of the way. They were respectful. They got it. It was a smart, hip audience. So, you know, it's harder to trick them, harder to work them. But when you do, it's a, you know, you come up with some great angle, like the Sandman blinding angle, whatever it may be. You know, the audience appreciates it all that much more. They're like, oh, I can't believe they got me. How did I get caught? You know, that was kind of a really cool back and forth thing. The chance. My God. First of all, Todd is God. Name of the book. Yep. Where did that come from? Came from the people in the arena screaming it or, you know, chanting it when I would come out, announcing whatever's going to happen next kind of thing. Each guy who came out, from Shaw, I mean, it was always each person. The guy who mopped up, they had mop boy chant for. And he worked for the building. I mean, but the fans were really, it was like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. They knew their spot. And they hit it every time.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it is. That's why I said ECW. I mean, and now, I mean, a lot of those things are just commonplace, right? That's just part of wrestling now. And yeah, ECW was the one, like I said, they impacted the direction and style of pro wrestling, you know, so much. You talked about the brawls, and a lot of times when people think of ECW, that's all they think about, right? They just think about the brawls and the violence and the blood. But there really was a lot more to ECW and really a lot of balance of styles. I mean, you had some great actual technical wrestlers and workers, and you introduced or helped introduce a lot of lucha guys into the U.S. and stuff. I mean, did you guys purposely set out to have this balance? I mean, did you feel that there had to be something to offset some of the violence every now and then and everything on your shows, or, you know, were you just booking the best talent you could find and that's how it worked out?
Well, you're 100% correct, but it's really a misconception to say that we were like this all violent promotion. Did we have super violence? Wasn't being seen like barbed wires and Singapore canes and things that became staples after, you know, we're gone? Yes, but that was never like, hey, how are you going to outdo that in the next match? No, it was like, no, what else we got? We had comedy. Public Enemy was comedy. The BWO was comedy. We had, you said, Matt Riddick, Guerrero, Malenko, Rey Mysterio Jr. I mean, there were some great technical wrestlers on those shows. There were some funny moments in those shows, and there was violence on those shows. And the women, I mean, we had a little bit of everything. That was the whole idea. It was something that I liked as a fan, because I was a fan just like everybody else was just watching the show. I went from being a fan to actually having a company by sheer luck and lightning in a bottle caught on and got to a national, you know, level. But that was never the intention at the beginning. I just wanted to do shows that I wanted to see. I hated what I was watching on TV. It was all cartoons. WWE actually had a cartoon in the morning on Saturdays. So,
yeah,
you know, that first main event when I had Abdul the Butcher, Terry Funk, Stan the Man, Lariat Hansen, and Kevin Sullivan. I mean, those four guys out there, that was something I wanted to see.
Yeah.
As a fan, I wanted to see it. If I wanted to see it, I knew the people who came to my shows wanted to see it too. So I just tried to put on shows that I found good. You know, and I hated being, as a fan, being ripped off. And I hated being, you know, worked. And I hated the bait and switch of the, we're going to unmask somebody at the end of this match. And then they pull the mask off, and there's another mask on underneath. It made me nuts. I hated that. And growing up, even as an adult. Someone's going to get stripped at the end of the, you know, stripper back. And they never did. Someone would come out, throw a coat on them, whatever it may be. The losing tag team will never tag again. Well, guess what? When we did that, Ian and Axel Rotten attacked him over 12 years at the time. Mm-hmm. Never tagged again. We honored our stipulations because we didn't insult the fans' intelligence. We treated the fans like they were as smart as we were. And I think that really was the key to the success of everything.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely do. And then, I mean, ECW, you mentioned a lot of guys there in that statement. ECW, a lot of people refer to them as, you know, the quote-unquote island of misfit toys, right? Where a lot of guys who couldn't break through somewhere else or didn't maybe have that, you know, they didn't have that WWE look or whatever it might be, became, you know, stars for you guys. And you guys obviously couldn't financially compete with the WWE and a WCW. So how important was it you find these overlooked wrestlers, come up with compelling gimmicks and you know, to keep your product fresh and rolling?
Well, that was the whole key, because sooner or later we knew, at least I knew, that the big boys were going to come and knock, and these guys were making like $500 a shot. We're soon to be making $200,000 or $300,000 a year working for Vince or Turner. So, you know, you always had a shelf life for the most part with a lot of them. You knew some of them you were going to lose, and you just hoped that wasn't going to be the case. But, you know, of course, the guys always saw the greener pastures. But locker room-wise, I remember Hulk coming in and saying, this locker room is literally a locker room of misfits. I said, yeah, it seems that way. And but they don't love that. They relished that role, and they loved the fact that they were the little engine that could. All these misfits all of a sudden banded together, being one giant misfit, and trying to take all the establishment of WCW and the WWE. And that was their mindset. Was like, you know, let's go to the next level. Let's do it together.
Yeah, and you spend a chapter and you talk about your posse, right? And you talk about those that were closest to you. And the one name that obviously is kind of one of your best friends is the Sandman. And I've always felt if there's one wrestler who's kind of the face of ECW or the poster of ECW, it's the Sandman. He encompasses everything about you guys, right? Your spirit and everything. What do you think, what made him work so well for ECW and its crowd? I mean, there was that entrance and everything. It's just, these are just iconic things. What was it about Sandman that clicked so well?
I do think his entrance is possibly, next, along with The Undertaker, one of the two best entrances in the history of professional wrestling. I mean, it's phenomenal hearing that whole building sing along. I guess one day, you know, I could just see his whole gimmick with the surfer, the bodysuit, the surfboard. It was flat. It was a WWF kind of character. And that's not what we had. So our guys were all hard-hitting, you know, rock and roll, let's knock it out of the park and party our asses off all night long. That was our guys. And Sandman was like that, but he was playing a character, and that never works. Not in Philadelphia, certainly. So once he decided, like, to ditch the surfboard, as we say, we sat down and talked to three of them. And then I went back and I said to Paul, listen, I got a great idea. Let's send this guy out to the ring, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes, like the guy at the end of the bar, looking for a barroom fight, which is basically who Sandman was at the time. Well, sure enough, Paul fought me on it for me. Then we agreed to do it. Sandman went to the ring. He got over like a rover. Oh, my God. People could not believe it. They're seeing a guy drinking beer and smoking in the ring. So it's a natural. It made him stand out so differently than everybody else that he's automatically getting over. And then Paul, with his brilliance, next started the following week on TV, he did something that had never been done before. Every match, every promo that Sandman did was in black and white. The rest of the show is color, but the Sandman part was always black and white. Again, it made him stand out. Like, what is this now? Why is this guy in black and white? And he would take a drag on that cigarette and blow out the smoke. You know, in the black and white, it just looks so amazing as an effect on the, you know, on TV. many years later, the NWO tried that. And they came out and were doing the black and white. But at to that point, Paul was the first one to do that there. And it really helped also get him over. Having a woman as a manager didn't hurt either. Yeah. But he was out, but he didn't mind. He'd go out there, he knocked the hell out of anybody and welcomed it back. You know, he wasn't putting his hands up, which he should have been, for all those chair shots back then. It's hurting him today, even, unfortunately. But yeah, he's a barroom brawler, and he was a real person. There was no bullshit with Sammy. I mean, but anything he said, anything was on his mind, he uttered out of his mouth. Like, he couldn't keep his mouth shut sometimes, for better or worse. But at least he knew he was shooting. He was always being honest, and I respected that because I've always been honest. And you know, he knew I didn't lie. I knew he didn't lie. We just, you know, we're had so much in common, from the same birth date to the not year but day, and to the love of Philadelphia sports, to just hanging out and laughing. We just were a natural fit. And 30 years later, he's still my best friend. We still hang out all the time.
Yeah, you talked about his early gimmick. I always wondered, has Hack ever, has he ever surfed?
No.
That's what I figured.
I don't even know where he stole the surfboard from.
Yeah, that's so odd to me that something like that was given to him. But so you talk in the book about the first ECW pay-per-view, Barely Legal. And you said that, and I don't know how you put it exactly, but that was kind of the beginning of the year. You knew that was the beginning of the end, right? You had overstepped. Yeah, the company had overstepped, and of course this was after Paul was in charge, but the company had overstepped, stretched too far, and that was the beginning of the end. But you also talk a lot about the earlier TV deals with MSG and Sunshine Networks and the impact that those had financially. Do you feel like those TV deals that Paul convinced you that he had the advertising sold and he could do that, and it never panned out? Do you feel like maybe those two TV deals really had the big first impact on you guys overstretching?
Well, 100%. We were trying to run before we had walked, kind of thing. First of all, the Sunshine Network, that was a gamble on both our parts. I mean, I knew that was a gamble. There was no one promising me anything on that. New York, that is a different deal. I mean, the MSG Network, he did tell me that he was Mr. Studio 54. Everybody in New York knew him. He had 10 people already clamoring to take ownership of the show in New York. I mean, they wouldn't sponsor us. So he said, don't worry about commercials. That thing will pay for itself. But we never had one commercial in New York, except for our own ECW commercials. So that was definitely a hit. I mean, you have to understand, MSG and Sunshine were each $3,000 a week. That's $6,000 times four. It's $24,000 a month. So think about that. And we're not bringing that back in. As many tapes as we sold, there's still VHS tapes. And we only sell so much of them. It's a sin that the internet wasn't around then, because my God, had it been 5 or 6 or even 8 years later, whatever, we could sell those shows at the arena for 5, 10, whatever it is, all over the country.
Yep.
We'd have been self-sustained in no time.
Yep.
Absolutely. We're just ahead. We're too soon for the internet. That really hurt us a lot.
Yeah. I think ECW's always had that feel, right? It was just like just slightly out of time. It is. I mean, a lot of these promotions now that are really, you know, successful now, and do the streaming and stuff, I always think, man, this is what ECW laid the foundation for, right? With the tape selling and everything else. That was the avenue you had. And it's that that DIY philosophy that all these groups do now. You guys were doing it then, but now they just have, there's just more tools to do it.
Yeah. And I don't know but they don't have the product to be successful like that. We became more successful even without that than they did with the use of the internet. It's amazing to me. It's astounding and certainly humbling. That's 30 years later, and people still yell at ECW at a show, because to them, what they're doing is they're saying, this is our feeling of something we like. We like this. This is, means ECW means it's good, you know? Like, and that shit on, they're going, yes, ECW, that's popping them. They still use those letters out. They did it Raw here in Philly like a couple months ago, a ball came out. The whole place started, 20,000 people yelling ECW. That astounds me, and it totally humbles me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And for those wondering, in the book, you hit and discuss all the hot button ECW items that people want to hear about. You talk about the Shane Douglas NWA title incident. You talk about mass transit. You talk about the flaming chair. But the one that seems like you need to clear up more than any other, and that you had to do, is your departure as the owner of ECW and the rumor of you being the mole for WCW. Now, we obviously don't want to give it all away, because we want people to buy the books. But what can you tell us a little bit and give kind of people a tease about that whole situation?
can tell people that they're going to be blown away when they find out that this was something that Paul and I orchestrated together. Only the conclusion didn't end the way we thought it was supposed to end. But yeah, that was a way for him to galvanize the locker room. Because the fact that they were really splintered at that point. They went from being this tight family-knit group to like cliques all of a sudden. There was the New York clique, the Philly clique. And Taz had his own clique. You know, one-man clique. But I'm just saying, the locker room was splintered. He was losing the locker room. There were issues, you know, with their cat and their money and things like that. And I said, well, I'm leaving because I just can't do this anymore. I'm not going to lie to the guys. You're asking me to lie. I'm not doing that. So we came up with this idea of, you know, phone call to Terry Taylor. We'll do this, but make it seem as though we're trying to take the company under. And that way the whole locker room would get back together and he'd do his Newt Rockne speech. You know, come on, guys. It's us against the world again. That's how we started. That's why we had that attitude. We've got to get back to that. So we got to all band together and, you know, fight off the outside world who's trying to take us apart. But no one ever thought about it, which is so, in retrospect, so logical. This is, you know, if I wanted to take the company down, all I had to do was take the music with me, the tapes with me.
Yep.
I mean, the tape library was the whole value of the company.
Yep.
I owned it. He needed it. He needed to be able to run shows and put a TV show on, say, and back 2 years ago or here and show a clip. Without that, not a clip to go on, it's, you know, that would have killed the company.
Yep.
So, of course, I wasn't trying to put the company down. I wanted to keep the company going because I needed to get all my money back that I had invested. And the only way to get that back is with the success of the company. But that logic apparently escaped a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, you talk a lot about that. I mean, for someone who is supposedly trying to bury it, yeah, you sure you worked with Paul a lot. I mean, they'll even you know, set up, you know, payment plans to buy the taste for you. Of course, you said that you had to go to Paul's mom a lot to get that money because of, you know.
Well, his parents were they were bankrolling, you know, in all fairness. They lost right. Millions of dollars, too, so. They're the bankroll, so that's what you want to make sure that, you know, you talk to about getting your payments.
Yeah, and it's like I said, you go thoroughly into this. I mean, this is clearly, this is probably one of the most talked about parts of the book, but it is, you talk about so much more, right? You hit, like I said, you hit everything.
Tell some great war stories about the road. You know, you'll hear some partying stories, you're hearing about sex stories. I mean, we were ECW. We did it all. We were hardcore. I mean, we were all kind of balls to the wall in those days. It was 30 years ago. I mean, in retrospect, you know, I used to joke back then saying, if you can pass a piss test, you can't work here. Instead of the other way around. But in retrospect, 30 years later, it's not so funny anymore.
Right.
All the deaths that we've had and stuff like that. But, you know, we were younger. You know, there's no such thing as AIDS that we knew of that back then. I mean, no one had ever heard of that, so they didn't worry about the blood in the ring that you would worry about it today. Yeah. There's just so many things that we, you know, we're still like the wild stallions. We knew nothing about going forward, but the parties and the stories that are in there are pretty goddamn funny, I mean, to honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, they definitely are. And like, you know, we talked earlier about people writing the story. I mean, you telling your story, you know, in all, you know, fairness, you could paint it any way you want, but you don't, you lay it all out there, you know, warts and all, and you own up to the things you did. Right. And you know, you're not just pointing fingers or telling stories of other people, right? It's a very honest telling, right? You come
wouldn't be fair to it wouldn't be fair to tell stories about other people and as though I was just an outsider looking in. I mean, that would be wrong on so many levels. So yeah, I took some lumps in the book and I admitted where my failings were or whatever they may have been. And 30 years later, now I'm older and I'm just hopefully in the golden years, so to speak, and I can just relax and enjoy it and remember these times for what they were, which was an incredible, incredible run.
Yep. And, you know, you haven't spoken to Paul Heyman in years. You say since the, you know, production of that DVD, his DVD set, which came out in 2014, and he, you know, you spoke on it, but then he kind of buried you. If, just say, you get on an elevator somewhere, and the door is closed, and it's just you and Paul Heyman in that elevator alone, what would you say to him?
Never should have ended like that.
Short and simple. And how do you think Paul would hear it?
No, he'd understand exactly. Listen, we were very simpatico. This guy is my best friend for years. I mean, we used to talk day and night, 7 days a week. I mean, my God, just the Dudley conversation alone, where we came up with about 75 different Dudley ideas, where we were falling on the ground laughing so hard. You know, we were tight, very tight. So I think what happens is how Eddie Gilbert was with Jerry Lawler, where he really wanted to be Jerry Lawler. And he brought that whole Memphis concept here, where he wore the crown and wanted to be the king of Philadelphia, where Jerry was king of Memphis. Well, I think Paul saw that as the success of the company grew, you know, and his name was now being bandied about as like the greatest mind in the history. You know, all of a sudden, he was getting credit for a lot of things. And I think he got some kind of delusions of wanting to be the next Vince.
Yep.
And in order to do that, he needed to be a single king, and Vince was ruthless. So he must have assumed that that's the best way to go about it, I guess. But it's hard to, you know, get inside somebody else's head and know all of his motivations. But that would be, you know, as close as I can come to as a guess.
Yeah. And that's one of the biggest things that I took from the book when I read it. Through the whole, you know, all these stories you tell and everything else. Like I said, you tell a lot of great stories. It's just, the saddest part of it all was me was this broken friendship between you and Paul. Like you said, you guys, you were very dissimilar people, but yet somehow it worked, right? You were like that odd couple that clipped.
We weren't dissimilar. We both had very similar backgrounds.
Okay.
We're both Jewish. He, middle class, good families. His family was, I loved his family. His parents were wonderful people. And I came from good stock too. My parents were wonderful people, but we were very similar. From the time we started hanging out a little bit, and we started talking about the Bugs Bunny cartoons, Warner Brothers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And we started doing the dialogue back and forth. You know, okay, Muggsy. And we knew the fact that we both knew pathetically the dialogue completely. You know, without missing a beat, and we would just play off of each other. That's what it was. Here's a story. I don't know if I told it in the book or not. I mentioned Warner Brothers. They had a cartoon with Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny. In this cartoon, as always, they try to outdo each other to become the number one act at the carnival or the show. In the very last maneuver, Daffy Duck swallows dynamite, blows up, and you see him floating away to the skies. The cartoon's ending. And Bugs says, "Daffy, I got to hand it to you, Claps. Got to give it to you that that's the best, greatest show I've ever seen in my life." And Daffy goes, "Yeah, but I can only do it once." One day we're in the locker room. We're talking with Cactus Jack about whatever had just gone on. He said, "This is getting crazy. This thing's getting so ultra-violent now that I feel like the only thing I have left is the Daffy Duck bump." And Paul and I looked at him and said, "What'd you say?" He said, "The Daffy Duck bump." You remember? I said, "Yeah, we remembered." Of course, we're so shocked when he said that. It was such a funny thing to say. So, yeah, I don't know if I put that in the book or not, but there's so many stories that didn't make it too.
Yeah, yeah, but like I said, though, that is one of these sets. I mean, because you guys are so close. Like you spoke daily and worked together so closely. I mean, you guys probably. I mean, I'm sure you spent more time with each other than you did, your families, and and for it to end that way, right? And how it ended with people being hurt. And now just, not no contact whatsoever.
After I was going from 97 so to from 97 to 2014, that's 17 years. We stayed friends for another 17 years after that.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't partners anymore, but we still were friends. We still cared about each other's lives.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, it's a great book, right? There's the wrestling story, but there's a lot of great human stories, right? You tell, like I said, you touched on everything that an ECW fan would want to hear about from your side. And, we talked about, WWE writes the history of these things. So it's nice to hear the non-corporate version of these stories and what actually happened.
You mean the authorized story.
The authorized story. There you go. That's right. That's in the title. Like we said, it's called Todd is God, the authorized story of how I created Extreme Championship Wrestling. You can get that from any book retailer in location online. So go out and get your copy of this. It's available now. I highly recommend it for everyone. Todd, thanks for coming on and talking to me about this book. I didn't want to spoil too much of the book, so we didn't go too deep into some of these stories, because I really want people to go out and read it in your words.
I love that. And I tell you what, I think you did a great job here. And I'm hoping maybe in a month or so we'll come back and then we can go into more depth about some of these stories.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy yours today. This
is extreme. There you have it, my interview with Todd Gordon.
Like I said, I did not want to give away too much from the book, right? Too many of the stories, because I want you guys to really go out and buy it and read it and support Todd and Sean and the book. But like, you know, like Todd said, he's agreed to come back in a couple months. Then we can really, we'll kind of feel like the spoiler territory is off, and we can really dive into some more stuff a little deeper. So go out and get that book. Again, it is called Todd is God, The Authorized Story of How I Created Extreme Championship Wrestling. It's available from all major book retailers. I got an early review copy of this book, right? I told Todd, I'm on a lot of lists with a lot of publishers where I get review copies of wrestling books. They know I have a wrestling podcast. And this book, I gave it a read, and it was a quick read for me, right? Because number one, like I said, I love ECW, so it was a topic I was interested in. And while I've read many books about ECW and this and that, and a lot of them, though, you know, have that spin on it, right? And I was really excited to hear Todd's side of it, because you don't hear that a lot, right? Todd has not been one of those guys who's been out there, you know, preaching to everybody about this and that and telling his side of the story. I was very excited to finally get to hear Todd's side of things. And the book was spectacular, right? It felt like you were sitting down, like I did here, and just had a conversation with Todd, and he was just telling these stories. And he said that's because that's what it was, right? That's what he was doing with Sean Oliver. He was just portraying these stories, and Sean was converting it over to books. So I think that format works so well. And Sean did a spectacular job of putting it together and in a chronological order, you know, and putting the pieces where they needed to be of these stories. I absolutely would love to hear some of these stories and hear some of the stories that didn't make the book. But like I said in the interview, Todd touches on all those hot button things, right? The Shane NWA title incident, mass transit, the flaming chair. But like I said, probably the biggest newsmaker, the most relevant thing, and when Todd was on Bob Smith's podcast, right, it made a lot of headlines where it came out. This was before the book was released, where it came out that Todd was going to tell his side of the story of how Paul Heyman gained control of ECW, and it's fascinating to hear and fascinating to read and the timeline of this, and it makes you scratch your head and realize there was something at play and something amiss with Paul Heyman's approach to this. And it seems like there was kind of a long game being played there that Todd got caught up in with Paul. And he talks about it, right? And how it went on for a while where you know, they gave the vision that Todd was still in control. And then when that started to fall apart, where, you know, Todd became the fall guy, right? The guy to babyface Paul Heyman and make him feel like the hero to the locker room. And Todd talks about that in the book. And of course, that touches on this long rumor that Todd Gordon was a mole for WCW, set to bring down ECW. And this rumor has been out there so long that people just accept it as fact. And it's not. It is not a fact. And Todd, he talks about the incidents that led to this rumor starting. And he pulls back the curtain on the Paul Heyman acquisition, quote unquote, of ECW and how that happened. But there's so much more to the book, right? That's like I said, that's probably one of the parts that everybody's going to key in on, because it's one of the most fascinating parts that we have never heard before. But there are so many great locker room stories, travel lodge stories from in Philly, lots of stories about the formation of Eastern Championship Wrestling before it became ECW. He talks, you know, he gives his side of the story and what really happened with the Shane Douglas throwing down the NWA title, which is another fascinating aspect of the history of ECW. And it's great to hear Todd tell his side. But what I like most, I think, about it all is, I mean, all this stuff is great, and hearing about these stories and hearing some of these facts, but is how Todd talks about the people, right? The wrestlers, the fans, some of the regulars at the arena and different things. And how he talks about them and how important they were and how much these people became, you know, a lot of them became his friends. And, he talks, right? He tells the stories. He tells, you know, some of the good, bad, and the ugly. But, you know, unlike a lot of books, a lot of shoot interviews, whatever else, it's not just the bad and the ugly. Todd balances it. Even people that
he claims that I didn't get along with and I didn't care for, he still gives good, right? He will still put some praise on them, right? He's not so caught up in grudges or any negativity where it's just he's trying to slam him. There's none of that, right? He speaks very honestly. He speaks very candidly and gives a very level telling of these things. And that includes him, right? He doesn't do the shine on himself and just try to make him look like anything more. He lays it all out there, warts and all, and he, you know, takes his lumps along with everybody else. And like you said, heard the interview, you know, he felt that was only fair. And I think it's refreshing in the world of professional wrestling because you don't hear that a lot, right? Especially knowing the corporate kind of rewriting of a lot of ECW's history. And like Todd said, and like I have said, and no one's going to deny how much of a creative genius Paul Heyman is. No one is going to deny the creative impact of Paul Heyman and ECW and how important that was and what that meant to what ECW was, what ECW became, and the legacy of it. No one denies that. But what's often lost in those discussions is Todd Gordon and how he founded this company, how he hired Paul Heyman, how much he worked with Paul Heyman, and some of the things that Todd Gordon did that established what ECW is today. He spoke of it in the book that in one of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter awards one year, he was voted as the third most powerful man in wrestling behind Vince McMahon and Eric Bischoff. This is for a company that at that time was just a small independent on the East Coast. That is spectacular and unbelievable and very, very true. So while Todd didn't set out to write a book to just toot his own horn, it was just telling of his side of the story. It does clarify some things that have been misinterpreted. It does clarify the importance of Todd Gordon in professional wrestling in ECW at that period. And it shows a little more clarity in the lineage of ECW and the importance of Todd Gordon and when it transitioned over to the importance of Paul Heyman, right? So again, Sean Oliver did a great job putting this book together. The pictures in it from George Tejinos and so many more are spectacular. There's a lot of great stories that you've heard over and over, but you don't, like I said, you've not heard them from Todd. And so that's very refreshing. So again, the book is amazing. I recommend, even if you're not necessarily a fan of ECW, and if you have that naive mindset that ECW is just hardcore, it definitely wasn't. But if you're a fan of professional wrestling, if you're a fan of professional wrestling history and some of the behind the scenes and the inner workings, this is a book that you want to read because it's fascinating of how this independent promotion on the East Coast became such a worldwide phenomenon, even beyond its own realm, right? ECW overextended what it should have, what it technically really could have, which, you know, kind of led to its demise, but it accomplished things that had never been accomplished. It accomplished things that it shouldn't have accomplished, but it did. And this book tells a lot of how and why, and it tells a lot of how of Todd Gordon's part in that. And he tells it, you know, he tells when it was someone else, when it was a Paul Heyman thing or when it was whatever, you know, he doesn't try to go in and put the corporate tarnish on it and tell that it was all him. He doesn't do that. He just tells the parts that were him and helps bring balance to this picture and brings it a little more in focus. And it's hearing the other side of the story, which is always the proper thing to do when you're looking at history in any capacity. So the book is spectacular. Once again, it's called Todd is God, the Authorized Story of How I Created Extreme Championship Wrestling by Todd Gordon and Sean Oliver. It's at all book retailers. Go out and get yourself a copy. I highly advise it. I know Todd's doing some appearances. He's been doing some convention stuff, popping up at some shows. So if you get that opportunity in your area, go out and see him. Say hi. Tell him Dave Dynasty sent you. And all's well. And like we said, Todd will be back in a couple months or so. And we'll shoot the shit a little more. And we'll talk a little more of the grime and the dirty and tell some of these stories and get into a lot of things that I didn't want to dive into today because I didn't want to spoil the book because the book's so freshly released, so new. It's just out, and I really want people to buy it. So So there you have it. That concludes this episode. Thank you to Todd Gordon for coming on. Thank you all for joining us. And make sure you follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads. All you have to do is look up at ECW Pod, and you can find us there. So give us a follow. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back in the near future with another episode here on This is Extreme. But until then, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.